The following podcast is brought to you by The Village Zendo. For more information, visit villagezendo.org.
It was so nice at the beginning of the last meditation period, listening to Bokushu and Seizan giving beginning meditation instruction to some of the newcomers. I first received meditation instruction in 2001, 2002, and I am so grateful. It was so small, and the consequences have been so boring and so profound. It's like a solar sail. Like, the pressure it exerts on my life is so subtle, and yet it's always pushing in the right direction. And over time, it's brought me to a completely different place than I would otherwise be. My name's Jiryu. I'm a senior student here. I'm going to talk about climbing. I talk about climbing a lot in my Zen talks because I'm learning so much about Zen from climbing at an indoor climbing gym. And today I want to talk about fear. A couple of months ago, I learned a more advanced technique for climbing. Before, I'd been doing something called top rope, where I'm attached to a rope as I climb up the wall. The rope loops around a pulley at the top of the wall, and then my belayer has the other end of the rope tied to a ratchet around her waist. And as I climb towards the pulley at the top of the wall, the belayer takes up the slack on the ratchet, and that means that if I fall at any point, which is pretty common, I'll only fall a couple of feet because the belayer has been taking up the slack, and as soon as the rope goes taut, she catches me. So it's not very scary, but I've graduated to a more advanced style called lead climbing, which is much more realistic. It's much more like outdoor climbing. And with lead climbing, I start on the ground next to the belayer, and we are attached to each other by a rope that's not very long. And as I climb up the wall, I take the rope with me. It's not looped around anything at the top of the wall. I have to take it up as I go. And every few feet, I'll reach a clip, a carabiner that's hanging off the wall, and pull up a loop of rope. I'm holding onto the wall with one hand, and I pull up a loop of rope with the other hand and clip it through the carabiner. And now I've achieved some degree of safety. The belayer pulls up the slack, and now if I fall after that, I'll only fall as far as below the last carabiner that I managed to clip. But it still kind of freaks me out because the falls that you take when you're lead climbing can be quite a bit greater. You'll fall down past your last clip and then past that even further, depending on how much slack and how bouncy the rope is. You might fall 10 or 15 feet before the rope catches you. I took my lead climbing class without a lot of difficulty, passed my certification test, and I have this climbing coach that I see about once a week, and he said, he was so excited, "You're lead certified now, let's go climb in the cave." The gym has this huge indoor cave made out of plywood and covered with plastic climbing holds, and you climb the cave. You can only do this on lead. You go up from the ground and climb up into the ceiling of the cave so that you are eventually hanging upside down like a sloth 20 feet above the ground. As you go, you clip the rope every few feet so that if you fall, you'll just like end up swinging in the space in the middle of the cave. And he got me on this climb, and I started doing it, and it was so exciting. It felt like a real climber like I saw in the movies. And I was doing great. I was remembering the technique, how to hold on to holds, how to keep my body weight evenly distributed, even though I'm upside down in this very difficult and unnatural position, clipping the rope into the carabiner as I go. And then I reach what for me was the hardest part, which is I reached the end of the cave, its mouth, and I needed to get around the lip that formed the mouth of the cave and up onto the wall, the vertical face that the cave had been sort of like, you know, excavated from. So I needed to go from hanging backwards to hanging off of a vertical wall, head up. And the route setters who had designed this climbing route were really pretty brutal, because I'd been climbing for many minutes, I had covered tens of feet, my hands were exhausted, my forearms were pumped full of blood. And just at this moment, they decide to give me a couple of really terrible holds. You can't wrap your hand around them. They're called slopers because they're just these kind of like textured blobs on the wall. You don't grab them, you just like press your hand on and hope that the friction will keep you from falling. So I got one hand on one of these slopers, and then with the other hand, I now have to get to the first clip outside the cave. I've got a lot of slack now behind me, maybe 5 or 6 feet. And of course, in order to get a loop of rope to attach to this carabiner, I have to pull up even more slack. So this is like the most vulnerable moment. And now I'm starting to feel afraid. You know, I can feel like my legs quivering, my heart is really racing, my breath is tight and short. If I'm breathing at all, who knows? And I'm sweating, which is the worst part, because my palms are now starting to kind of create a thin layer of mud formed by climbing chalk and sweat, which does not stick to that slopey hold at all. And I feel it start to slip. And I'm like, I'm trying to get this damn rope into the carabiner, and the carabiner is at like an awkward angle, and I just, with just one hand, I can't get that loop of rope through the gate of the spring-loaded carabiner and safely through it. And at the moment that my left hand starts to actually begin to move, I just shout, "Falling," and I fall. And I'm fine. Maybe it's a little comical, but I end up swinging 10 feet off the ground like a, you know, yo-yo that just failed its trick over the head of my belayer. And I say, "Can I continue? Is there any way to get back on the wall from here?" And my belayer, my coach, says, "No, you're coming down." And he lowers me. And he had such a look of like startle, and he said, "That was the worst place you could possibly have fallen." You know how a little kid, when they fall, they're like shocked and they stare into their parents' eyes? And if the parent is calm, the kid's fine. But if the parent is afraid, then the kid is like completely loses it. That was me. I was fine until I saw the look on my coach's face, and then all of a sudden I was losing it. It's like, man, what could have happened to me? I think in retrospect I misinterpreted it. It really was pretty safe, but it scared me at the moment. I didn't get right back on the wall then. I kind of walked away with this like queasy sense like something had gone wrong, something I could have been hurt. A few days later was the next time that I tried lead climbing, and I was really surprised at how scared I was. All of a sudden, this thing that I'd been doing without much trouble a few times before, now it was freaking me out. Just strapping on the proper gear for that style of climbing already started my heart beating a little bit faster. And as soon as I started climbing up the wall and clipping the rope in, I got distracted by these anticipating thoughts, starting to visualize, oh, I'm going to fall here. Oh, I'm going to fall here, and my finger is going to get caught in the clip, and I'm going to like rip my skin, or I'm going to like fall and hit my butt on a hold, and it's going to break my pelvis, and just, you know, it's like disasters flashing through my head. And I was sweating and hyperventilating, and like the slightest fatigue in my hands would suddenly make me feel like I couldn't possibly continue the climb. And very often, for those first few weeks when I was getting over that scare, I would be on the wall trying to climb and I would panic. And I would be unable to continue. I'd be trying to make that clip. The closer the situation was to the moment that I had fallen first, if there was some bad hold in one hand and I couldn't get the rope into the clip in the other and I felt tired, like all of those aspects of the original trauma, the more of them that resembled that, the more likely I was to switch over from manageable fear to unmanageable panic. And I would just shout, take up the slack, and I would like lower myself down a couple of holds and deliberately fall because I just could not continue. Fear happens all the time. Fear is something that we can practice with. Panic is when we can't practice with it. When the self that is capable of intentionally working with the fear is blown away, and all that's left is the fear and the helplessness. And that's panic. Panic is an animal experience of being alone and naked and disoriented in the dark and paralyzed. But if we say that panic is when you're so scared that yourself is obliterated, maybe that's a good thing. The project of Zen is to liberate us from our sense of a isolated self, to recognize that we are one with all of this. So maybe that experience of a loss of self when we panic, maybe that's great. Maybe we should try to practice that more often. After all, the first koan that we study when we begin practicing Zen is, what is mu? And you cannot answer that question while viewing yourself as a separate I. So maybe we should be panicked all the time. There's this excellent Chinese Zen teacher named Sheng Yan. He was born in China and taught in Taiwan. He died in 2009. Sheng Yan wrote, "The purpose of practice is ultimately to let go of the sense of self. But in the beginning, we need to affirm the self as a vehicle for practice. We settle the mind by contemplating the breath going in and out of the nostrils. We are aware of who is breathing. To affirm your sense of self, use the awareness of your whole being as a point of reference. With a strong sense of self, you have a foundation for taking up what is mu." So Sheng Yan says we actually need a very strong sense of self. That makes sense because we have to practice with such determination. We have to keep promises to ourselves. How else could we practice except with a strong sense of who we are? Otherwise, we're just going to get knocked off of our practice the first time we experience something unpleasant, something scary, something that we would rather distract ourselves from. For me, the main reason that I have distracting thoughts during Zazen is anxiety about the future. Some small fear. What am I going to say in my Dharma talk tonight? What am I going to say at the meeting with my boss tomorrow? How am I going to solve that problem? My obsessive need to think about these things that might go wrong and to try to solve that problem by thinking is the main distraction that I struggle with during meditation. And I think that this is true of a lot of meditators, and I think it's been true for a very long time. There's a line in the Surangama Sutra, which was written maybe 700 AD. The line goes, "If you arouse your mind even momentarily, anxiety over the material world will come up first." So we have to face our fears in order to practice. And when we face these fears, we actually need a very strong sense of who we are in order to deliberately confront these fears, to allow ourselves to experience it without letting ourselves get caught up in distracting thoughts. We have to prevent panic. Panic as a dissolution of the self, it's very different from samadhi. Samadhi is a liberation that expands the self to be the entire world. Panic shrinks it until all of experience is just fear. Samadhi is not knowing, but it's a not knowing that's omniscient. And panic is a not knowing that is helpless and disoriented in the dark. So the courage we need to face our experience but not panic, that courage is actually born of a strong sense of who we are. A couple of years ago I did a week-long meditation retreat, a session that was the most intense of any that I have ever done. I went into it with, I had just completely lost confidence in my life and in the choices I had made. My relationship with my partner was really bitter and resentful and silent. And I didn't know if we could fix it. At work, this company that I'd worked for 6 years, where I'd been so successful, suddenly I was disrespected, my ideas were dismissed. I had reached a dead end in my work, and I thought I might have to quit, and I didn't know where I would go. So I sat with these two feelings of just complete not knowing the answer for a week. And the temptation was so strong to think about these two problems. What am I going to do? But instead, I kept putting those thoughts down and just returning to feeling the feeling, which was fear. I have a problem and I don't know how to fix it. It was a tingling in my stomach, sweating, the heart beating fast, breath tight, a line of heat going up from the pit of my stomach to my heart, and just the flame going up in an endless cycle through this line of fire. By the end of a week of that, when we finally finished the retreat and I was ready to talk again, I could not wait any longer to start fixing my life. I talked to my partner, I described what had happened. Within a year, we were in therapy and starting to really turn our ship around. At work, I began the process of switching teams to find a team where I could contribute again. That was a hell of a meditation retreat. And a few months later, when I was going to do another week long, I was kind of apprehensive. I thought, am I going to have to spend another week like with this line of fearsome fire burning in my body? But at the same time, I was sort of excited, like something is finally happening in my meditation practice. It's not the same old, boring, drowsy, daydreaming, boring crap. Like, something's actually happening. It's intense and emotional and unpredictable. So great, so let's do this. And we started the meditation retreat, and zilch, you know? Just the regular old daydreaming. Back to business as usual. Kind of disappointing. Turns out my practice is just like it's always been. And ordinariness is a monster too. And I run from that monster too when things get too routine. I need to start taking risks, maybe swerve a little closer to a car in traffic, or take on some project at work that I actually don't think I can succeed at. I need some fresh challenge, some risk. Because ordinariness is scary. Like, as soon as it sets in, I start to panic. I think, like, what if this is all there is from now on, forever? You know Jean-Paul Sartre's play, No Exit? Hell is people stuck in a room forever. There's no torture. It's a nice drawing room. They have coffee. The horror of it is that it will always be the same. And this happens to us too when we get bored. Boredom is also scary. I remember when I did my first week-long meditation retreat 18 years ago or so, I was afraid of it. And maybe you've been afraid too. Like, maybe you remember being afraid the first time you did a day or even half an hour of meditation. What was scary? Could have been pain. But other than that, it might have been boredom. And when I have been afraid of starting very long meditation retreats, often the thing that I'm afraid of is being bored. Which is a funny thing. It's like a paradox. But it is scary. This is meditation's main teaching, though, is to accept boredom, not to fix it by entertaining ourselves, but to sink into it and see what its contents actually are. I see people walking around all the time, preventing boredom like it's a matter of life or death. Like, they must be terrified of boredom. Very often in my office, when I go to the bathroom, the men on either side of me at the urinals are all looking at their phones while they pee. Like, they are steadying their penises with one hand and they are scrolling with the other. What poor, nervous, terrified people that they might risk a moment of ordinariness, and how desperately they are searching their phones for something to make this moment special. But I don't do that, right? We don't do that because we're Zen students. And we know that this moment is special already. The miracle of the kidneys, the gift of water. This moment will never exactly recur. We should value it. Besides, any moment that you can practice, it's worth practicing, because these ordinary moments are a good time to train, because the moment of panic will come sooner or later. And if you wait until then to learn how to accept and concentrate on this experience, if you wait, it might be too late. The panic will come, the naked, alone animal fear, the darkness. So I'm determined to keep working on this fear, and climbing is a wonderful opportunity, because now I've got something I'm afraid of and I can do it. My strategy is to work at 90% panic level. So pretty afraid, but still I know who I am and I can practice and work with that fear. I can essentially do meditation on the climbing wall. Because if I hit 100%, I'll panic and I'll give up. I'll say, take up the slack, I'll lower myself down, and that reflex of, here's the situation, and what happens is I get paralyzed, that will only get stronger the more I let it happen. So I get right up to the edge, and then I work through it. You know, even though I'm shaking and sweating, my hand is barely holding on, it feels like, and I can't get the damn rope into that fiddly little carabiner, I stick with it and I do it. And then the next time I'm a little less afraid and I can try a climb that's a little harder. The two techniques that are really working for me when I'm climbing are, first of all, to just concentrate on what I'm doing. What my disorganized mind really wants to do is either visualize accidents that are about to happen. That's clearly not helpful. And then the other thing it likes to do is to come up with reassuring thoughts. You know, you're on a rope, you're safe, your belayer is paying attention, you won't fall very far. That is also not helpful. What's helpful is to really feel my body, my hands, my feet, to look at the carabiner, to look at the rope, to remember the exact motion that will get that rope past that spring. Just concentrate on this exact moment and the skill that I am practicing. And the other thing that helps, of course, is to breathe. Slowly. Especially to slow down the out-breath. Doing the horse breath actually really helps. You'll often hear climbers do this. You can try putting your hand over your heart. You'll actually slow it down. You can feel it. The space between the beats is greater as you exhale slowly. Try it next time somebody's taking your pulse. It's kind of fun to trick them. Wow, you're only 50? You must be a marathoner. It really works. And there will come a time when the panic will come, and this will help. And even if it's not you know, falling off a wall or turning your life upside down can just be like the ordinary anxiety that comes up as we meditate, right? The thoughts about, how am I going to deal with that problem tomorrow? What does that person think of me? We can do the same thing with them there. Just letting the breath out really slowly and deliberately. If the thoughts are coming up, catastrophizing or planning or trying to reassure you, you can drop those too. A technique that we often teach is to count the breath. One in your mind, and then the next one, two, all the way up to 10, and then starting over at one again. That helps keep us here, breathing, concentrating on what we are actually doing, the experience of our bodies in the room. The self that can work with fear in this way is the self that we're going to use as our raft to get us to the liberated shore, that has the determination to work with the fear to face whatever we're going to see on these meditation sessions or days or weeks, that is determined to keep facing ourselves, confronting what we really are, in order to liberate ourselves from this scared and isolated little being that we're trapped in. When the panic comes, it risks killing that self. You know, maybe it will be the actual death at the end of our lives, or maybe a little death of just that moment when we're obliterated and can't work with our fear anymore. That's the ultimate test of our practice. The Zen teacher Mumon says this about that moment. Know that coming out of one husk and getting into another, it's like a traveler putting up in hotels. In case you are not yet enlightened, do not rush about blindly. When suddenly earth, water, fire, and air are decomposed, you will be like a crab fallen into boiling water, struggling with its seven arms and eight legs. Do not say then that I have not warned you.